Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent in Brussels talks about the suspects in Tuesday's bombings. An analyst speaks with us about President Obama's visit to Argentina. An author finds strengths for today's U.S. candidates in a past politician.
Who would basically say to his constituents, I'm not going to do what I think you want me to do because it's wrong. And my obligation to you is to do what's right.
And singer Meghan Trainor just says no. It's right here on The Voice of America. A moment of silence was observed today in Belgium for the victims of the terrorist attacks at the Brussels airport and a subway station. At least 34 people were killed and more than 200 were wounded in the bombings. Correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Brussels and joins us on the line. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
What do we know about the three suspects in this case?
Well, the police have identified two of the suspects that you may have seen on the internet on a CCTV still shot. There are two suspects that you could see their faces. Those two guys are believed to be brothers who both died in the attack. They were suicide bombers. The third suspect was being searched for over the past 24 hours, and we've just gotten reports through local media that they have caught the third suspect. The police say that there also may be a fourth suspect in the airport bombing that they're still looking for.
What do we know about the third suspect?
We don't know a whole lot quite yet. We do believe that he is connected to the brothers, and the brothers themselves are connected to Salah Abdeslam, who was arrested in Paris or is jailed in Paris in connection with the Paris attacks.
Are there other links with the Paris attacks?
Yes. In fact, Abdeslam was arrested 4 days before the attack in Belgium, and there is a question about whether the timing of this attack, while it was clearly planned far in advance, if the timing was connected to his arrest. The brothers themselves are believed to be connected to him, and if that is confirmed, it will show a direct link between the two attacks. Also in common, the Islamic State group has taken responsibility for both attacks.
You've had a little bit of time to wander the streets. So what is the general mood there in Brussels following Tuesday's attacks?
I've heard a lot of people say that they are really disappointed and sad and hope it doesn't happen again. But it's not over. People are still scared. Some people are missing. More than 200 people were injured. So a lot of people are, you know, trying to take care of their loved ones, keep safe. People are out on the streets. People are continuing on with their daily lives, but it's quite a shock to this community here.
And what about security? Are you seeing it on the street?
There is a lot of security. There are a lot of police on the streets, but some local people tell me that the police in Brussels are not prepared for these kind of security operations and don't usually carry weapons or have dogs, and so they worry that while there is a strong police presence, this isn't a militant zone, so fighting this kind of battle is not something Belgium is prepared for. At least that's what the local people are telling me.
And Belgium is such an important city in Europe.
Yes. It's a beautiful city. Besides being geopolitically important, it's also a tourism hub, and that's a great worry for the local people here, is that it's going to really harm the tourism for a long time to come.
Well, thank you very much, Heather. I appreciate you speaking with us.
Thank you.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And on the line is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me remotely.
What have you found out on the web?
Well, as Heather mentioned, the third suspect, there were initial reports that he was arrested, Najim Lashraoui. In fact, that name was trending on the top of Twitter this morning amid the reports of his arrest. But now there's conflicting information. The Belgian authorities are actually walking that back, reportedly saying they haven't arrested him. So there's a bit of a back and forth on social media, people trying to clarify whether he indeed has been arrested or has not. But it looks like, according to the Belgian authorities, he has not been arrested at this point.
Is there any tweets or anything about concern for security elsewhere in the world?
Oh, absolutely. We saw here in the U.S. a lot of pictures from places like New York's Penn Station, Union Station here in Washington, D.C., other places where there was an increased security presence. You see police with some very heavy guns walking through. And so people are a little more concerned on that, a little bit of a heightened alert because of this, and sharing that throughout social media.
And they had a moment of silence for the victims of these bombings. I'm sure those pictures will be coming out too.
Absolutely. And yesterday we talked about a lot of the similarities between the Paris attacks in November and these attacks in terms of the social media outreach and support. And one of those that we've seen develop in the past few hours is a photo where you actually have it, let's say, kind of a Belgian flag or a person in the Belgian flag colors, the black, yellow, and red, being comforted by someone who has the French flag colors on their body. So it's kind of a solidarity picture that's been spreading around the internet, going viral, saying to the people of Belgium, we support you, the people of Paris support you, and the people around the world support you.
And it was interesting how quickly they got the pictures of these suspects out, the two suicide bombers and then the third person. And those pictures have been everywhere almost immediately.
Absolutely. And that's a valuable way social media can be used in cases like this to get that information out there. Now, it is important to note that when the information is correct, it's valuable. I remember back in the U.S. during the Boston Marathon bombings, a lot of people would put out pictures on social media of suspects that didn't actually end up being the suspects that they arrested. So it's always important to make sure the information is correct, and indeed that's what we're seeing with this arrest report this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
And I'll see you a little later today.
Sounds good.
Okay, this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Back in 2011, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope captured two red supergiant stars as they exploded into supernovae. Astronomers studying the Kepler data were able to not only watch both stars as they exploded, but for the first time spot the tremendous shockwave produced deep inside the smaller of the two as its core collapsed. Called KSN 2011A, the smaller supernova is only 700 million light years away from us and is nearly 300 times the size of our sun. The other, called KSN 2011D, is located 1.2 billion light years away and had 500 times the solar mass of the sun. The supernova shockwave is described as resembling a nuclear explosion on a massive scale. The astronomers say that their observations will help scientists better understand how the earliest moments of a star's explosive death is affected by its makeup and size. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
President Obama is in Argentina today, where he will meet his Argentine counterpart, newly elected right of center Mauricio Macri, who is trying to implement reforms to combat the Latin country's massive debt and double-digit inflation. Mr. Macri is seeking foreign investment, and Mr. Obama is accompanied by American businessmen. The visit comes as Argentines mark the 40th anniversary of a military coup that brought a junta to power accused of massive rights abuses. Mr. Obama's two-day visit follows a historic three-day stop in Cuba, the first visit to the communist-ruled island nation by a sitting U.S. president in 88 years. The president was able to speak to the Cuban people on state-run television after reestablishing diplomatic relations after a 55-year break.
Like so many people in both of our countries, my lifetime has spanned a time of isolation between us. As the decades rolled by, our government settled into a seemingly endless confrontation, fighting battles through proxies. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people. Now, I want to be clear. The differences between our governments over these many years are real, and they are important. We cannot and should not ignore the very real differences that we have about how we organize our governments, our economies, and our societies. Despite these differences, on December 17, 2014, President Castro and I announced that the United States and Cuba would begin a process to normalize relations between our countries. Many people on both sides of this debate have asked, why now? There is one simple answer. What the United States was doing was not working. A policy of isolation designed for the Cold War made little sense in the 21st century. The embargo was only hurting the Cuban people instead of helping them. As President of the United States, I've called on our Congress to lift the embargo. It is an outdated burden on the Cuban people. It's a burden on the Americans who want to work and do business or invest here in Cuba. It's time to lift the embargo.
But he said even with a lifting of the embargo, Cubans would not realize their potential without change, requiring political, economic, and social reforms. Peter Hockham is president emeritus and senior fellow at the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about Mr. Obama's efforts to open up Cuba. As for Argentina, Hakim says Mr. Obama hopes to reverse past strained U.S. relations with Buenos Aires.
We've largely been distant from one another. The U.S. has largely ignored Argentina for the past 12 years because there was differences between us and your government, and your government often was unpredictable. But now that the government has changed, we want to make sure you understand that the United States government, that President Obama wants a solid relationship with Argentina. That's a straightforward message.
Turning to Cuba, he left after addressing the Cuban people an extraordinary message. It called for democracy and economic reform. He said he came to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. Did he accomplish that?
He's gone a long way toward that. I think he's put one of the final nails in the coffin, if you like. The whole Cold War episode, the U.S. interventions, support of military dictators won't leave the consciousness of Latin Americans for some time. There's going to be, particularly of people who were on the left and often suffered the consequences of U.S. Cold War actions, may well continue to be suspicious and distrustful of the United States. It's going to take a while.
He called for political and economic reform in Cuba. Will that message ring true over the coming months and years in Cuba?
That's, of course, up to the Cubans, mainly, as he himself said. They've resisted any such message for 55 years. I think it's hard to know at this point. The Cuban government has certainly shown very little willingness to give up control, whether it's over the way the economy works, whether it's the way that small businesses are set up, or on the bigger themes of democratic elections or human rights. It may work. They may become a little more trusting, a little more goodwill toward the United States. But frankly, I think it's just generally unpredictable at this stage.
What about the future of the U.S. trade embargo?
I think the embargo is slowly eroding, fading away. And I suspect that there's a very high possibility that it might be eliminated in the next year or two with or without Obama in office.
And Peter Hockham says the Obama visit to Cuba is part of the so-called Obama Doctrine, a view that it is better to engage with adversaries rather than isolate and punish them, which he says hasn't worked. He cites two countries where this is being tested with uncertain results, Cuba and Iran. Coming up on International Edition, a former U.S. politician might be a help to modern candidates. And some girlfriend advice, say no. Americans are seeking a new leader. The nation is going through the long process of choosing nominees to run for president. Candidates debate and meet with the public and tour the country for rallies and speeches. Author James Traub can tell us about one politician who repeatedly risked his political career to defend his principles. And the professor joins us on the line to talk about his book, John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit, and the current race for the White House. Welcome, James.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. What would you say were the strongest political assets of the sixth president of the United States?
Well, unfortunately, his strongest assets weren't political. That was his problem. His strongest assets were that, first of all, he was a person of unbelievable mental gifts. He was just a super smart person who spoke half a dozen languages or so, probably had almost all of Shakespeare, almost all of Homer, almost all of the English classics at his fingertips. I mean, just a person you would have been astonished to talk to. A deep sense, overwhelming sense of public commitment. I mean, he was a man who was quite willing, I mean, as you said in your introduction, to risk his political future. He was willing to risk his life. And on any number of occasions, for example, when he was He was the target of innumerable death threats after he was president, when he came back to the Congress and he really stood up against the slave power. And I've read all these letters that were written to him that contain explicit death threats of the sort that I will come next week and shoot you with a gun in the street there. And he did nothing whatsoever to change his habits, nothing. So that sense of heightened public service.
How is Adams relevant to today's American political scene?
You know, I have to say in a kind of reverse way, because I would never say, and I didn't when I wrote the book set out to say, he will remind you of blank, whether you the blank is someone else whose father was a president like Jeb Bush, or whether he's like Barack Obama. If anything, you know, he was an archaic figure even in his own time, and certainly he is in many ways today. So when we look at his virtues and we look at his flaws, we see something unfamiliar, but I think something that reminds us of other ways of being. I mean, his utter indifference to the political costs of what he did, it merited him the first chapter of John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, and Kennedy used Adams' life to talk about political courage. Well, it's not easy to think of a figure today who would so utterly, who would basically say to his constituents, I'm not going to do what I think you want me to do because it's wrong, and my obligation to you is to do what's right. But I think as we look for people who don't purely think about the world in polling terms, and we feel have a kind of North Star of firm conviction, I don't think anyone can be held to Adams' impossible standards, and it needs to be said. For that reason, for the reason of his stubbornness, he wasn't a very effective president. We probably need people, more people like, say, I think of someone like Bill Clinton, who was more Machiavellian. And yet, those old Republican, and I mean that with a small r, virtues, that is, of a world that wasn't really fully democratic with a small d, it wasn't really about popular democracy, and Adams felt like, I serve the public well, therefore I should become president, in a way that nobody would ever say today. But those were incredibly firm convictions that allowed him to stand up for principles, even when he felt that he was all alone. It allowed him to be an unshakable figure.
The name of your book again?
Yes, the name of my book is Militant Spirit, and he was a militant spirit.
John Quincy Adams. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
A pleasure, Susan.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There's no certain way to prevent dementia in individuals. We might be able to reduce the numbers of people, perhaps by 10, maybe 20, maybe even 30%.
That's Dr. Simon Ridley with Alzheimer's Research UK talking about a new study that concludes that exercise and healthful eating habits can dramatically decrease the risk of getting dementia. The conclusion seems like common sense to people on the streets of London.
It doesn't surprise me because I can even tell from a personal point of view that exercise and healthy eating makes me feel so much better.
If you get plenty of exercise and keep your mind active, that you know, you will sort of stave off dementia and Alzheimer's, things like that.
Some 45 million people worldwide are living with dementia, a number that is expected to nearly triple by 2050. There's no cure for it, but experts say that not smoking and staying active may help people to keep their minds healthy. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Today in our music feature, we're going to revert to an old saying people used to say, what you should say when you are offered illegal drugs, and that is, just say no. And Larry London is here to explain what that has to do with the music world. Larry, welcome.
Well, it's nice to be back with you, Susan. Welcome back. It's been a few weeks.
Thank
you. But today we're talking about a brand new song from the 22-year-old Massachusetts native who just got the Grammy for Best New Artist. Her name is Meghan Trainor. She has her second album coming out this year. No release date yet, but it's called Thank You, the album. And the new song is a very different sound. It's Caribbean influenced. She was channeling Britney Spears and Madonna, and she herself confesses her inner Missy Elliott with this new song, which I love. It's called No. And I had predicted this song is going to go to number one. It's debuted at number 11 already on Billboard. Its first week, I predict this is a number one hit, just like her song, All About That Bass.
And what's she saying no to?
She is saying no. It's kind of a message for women. It's a women empowerment song. Meghan Trainor calls this her Beyonce single ladies hit. She says, this is for girls who are tired of being chased by guys. And when they ask for your phone number, they ask for your horoscope sign, say no, 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 no. That's kind of what the message in the song is all about. No, say no to the guys.
My name is no, my sign is no, my number is no. You need to let it go, you need to let it go, need to let it go. First you gonna say, you ain't running game.
Well, what else is on this album?
Well, we haven't heard much because all she's released is the single. Mm-hmm. The album hasn't come out, so she's teasing us with this new song. She has a new look. She has red hair for the first time in her life.
What did she have before?
She had blondish, brownish hair, and so now it's a color of red.
Maybe she should have said no to her hairdresser.
Very good for you. She's going off in a new direction, and I assume we'll see her on tour. She had to cut her tour short last year because of throat surgery. She had vocal issues.
Oh, that's serious.
Yes, it is. But she's back, and she sounds great. And by the way, this song, she says, was written out of anger. And I've heard her tell the story in interviews recently where she said that L.A. Reid, her boss at Epic Records, listened to the new album, the album Thank You, and said to her, there's no hit on this album. I don't hear a hit.
Well, that's mean.
It is mean. And so she left that very day, and out of anger and spite, she sat down and wrote the song, which is going to be a hit, is already a hit for that matter. The song is called No.
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 Okay. Thank you very much, Larry.
No.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ancient spring festival of Nowruz is currently being celebrated by millions of people around the world, including Iranians, Kurds, Afghans, Azeris, Americans, and the peoples of Central Asia. Secretary of State John Kerry sent his best wishes to them all for a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. Nowruz, he said, is a time of renewal and reconciliation, a chance for families to celebrate their heritage and culture, reflect on the past 12 months, and look forward to the year ahead. In his Nowruz greeting, President Barack Obama again used the occasion to speak directly to the people of Iran.
Over the years, you've heard me say that the United States was prepared to engage with Iran in a spirit of mutual interest and mutual respect. Well, that's exactly what we did. In the last few years, our diplomats and nuclear scientists sat down together and negotiated face to face. And last summer, along with our international partners, we reached the historic deal on Iran's nuclear program.
President Obama noted that Iran has fulfilled key commitments under the deal, rolling back critical parts of its nuclear program and agreeing to verification measures to assure the world its nuclear program is and will remain peaceful. In return, the international community lifted certain sanctions on Iran.
Iran now has the opportunity to begin reintegrating itself with the global economy. That means more trade and investment, which will mean more jobs, including for young Iranians who dream of pursuing their careers and making their mark on the world.
President Obama stressed that the nuclear deal will not solve all the disputes between Iran and the United States. But even as our two governments continue to have serious disagreements, he said, the fact that we are now talking to each other on a regular basis for the first time in decades gives us an opportunity to solve other issues. In addressing the Iranian people, President Obama spoke of his historic trip this week to Cuba. My visit, he said, will be a reminder that, even after decades of mistrust, it is possible for old adversaries to start down a new path. As you and your families welcome the new spring this Nowruz, I hope that the friendship and ties between the American and Iranian people will continue to grow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.